Thank you for all coming back. I always like it when people I found the lost paper, so I can now do May Sarton justice. From her book, At 70. So I'll read the whole quote. What is it like to be 70? If someone else had lived so long and could remember things 60 years ago with great clarity, she would seem very old to me. But I do not feel old at all. Not as much a survivor as a person still on her way. I suppose real old age begins when one looks backward rather than forward. And I look forward with joy to the years ahead, and especially to the surprises that any day may bring. And then this one I also love. In the middle of the night, things well up from the past that are not always cause for rejoicing. The unsolved, the painful encounters, the mistakes, the reasons for shame and woe. But all, good or bad, painful or delightful, weave themselves into a rich tapestry and give me food for thought, food to grow on. I think that's what we're we're beginning to get. So now it's your turn. So what do you have to say about this?
Could I start, since I've got the microphone? Could I start?
Okay.
I'd like to say a couple of things only. My dad grew up in rural Louisiana, and it was a French culture. In fact, there was a French Catholic church in the town. And he told me that whenever there was a funeral in the town and the hearse would come by down the main street, everyone in the town shut their blinds. Now, this was a cultural way of more or less shunning and, you know, I don't know why, but this is the way it was done. You shut your blinds as the corpse went by and to the graveyard. Then the other thing I wanted to mention was that some years ago we were at Case Western Reserve, and there was a Jesuit priest who was also a psychologist who taught the medical students a lot about stuff they didn't know about, maybe second half of life stuff, issues of psychology, sexuality, and all that. And he used to describe what he called something that they all had to learn about, which he called the tragic triad of life. And the tragic triad consisted of failure, suffering, and death. And these are the things you were mentioning that we tend to not think about or avoid, you know. And, you know, as I've reflected over the years on that tragic triad, I realized that that's something, you know, in the last few weeks of Jesus' life in particular, he walked straight ahead into an embrace of those of the tragic triad, the failure, the suffering, and the death. And it's not the end of the story, but it's very sobering to think about that.
Yes, thank you.
Hi. My sister-in-law had cancer, lung cancer, and we brought her home to die with us. And I had an 8-year-old at the time, who's now 14. And my friends just, some of them thought it was horrible. Like, how could you do that to your child? And I remember talking to my daughter before we did this, you know, and saying, you know, Auntie Shelley's sick and Auntie Shelley's going to die. And, you know, I said, and I want you to know if it gets too rough or something, we can always make another choice, you know. There's another place where Auntie Shelley could go to the hospital, but, you know, we think, this is where Auntie Shelley wants to be and we want to do this with her. Are for her, but, and she said, Mom, she said, I think it's all right. And I said, yeah, it's okay. And she said, Mom, how long is it gonna last? And I said, what do you mean, Auntie Shelley dying? Or she goes, no, like the hurt. How long's the hurt gonna last?
Oh, okay.
And I said, well, you know, it'll last as long as it lasts, and it'll, you know. But the thing is, my daughter said, well, Mom, I said, you know, but are you okay? And she said, I said, you know, is it all right? And she said, yeah. She goes, Mom, I think it's going to make us all better. And I said, yes. I think, I said, I don't know, Caitlin, but what I do know is it will affect the person you've become. And, you know, it was great. The night before my sister-in-law died, my daughter got in bed with her because she was at home with us. And she got in there with her. And my sister-in-law hadn't talked for like 2 days. And my daughter said, I love you, Auntie Shelley. And she came awake and she said, I love you too. And, you know, it's so, but I mean, the pressure from my friends, because, of course, everybody was helping me carpool her and, you know, whatever. And she hasn't had any problems. Yeah. I mean,
That's so important.
But even, you know, so.
Well, you know, one of my jobs at hospice, I ended up becoming the director of education. And one of my jobs then, and I love this part, it was a time when everybody was starting to wake up to this. And so the preschools asked us to come. And I would go to the preschool and talk to the parents. Not to the children, but to the parents. And we found amazing stories there of people who themselves had had horrible experiences about being in the house with the blinds down when their grandmother died, or some, you know, where they were. And then, of course, their minds went to the worst. And so it was a fascinating thing. It was a mutual learning for us that children really already know, you know, and with no place to talk about it. That's where it begins, isn't it? You know, this shutting down of things that are taboo.
I want to go back to, it's over here, Ann.
Oh, yeah. Oh, there you are.
To the spiral that you were talking about. And I, through the book, I've struggled with that concept because it's as if we're always spiraling up, but there's those times in our lives when we just crash and it's as if we're not even a part of the spiral. And last night as I was falling asleep, an image came to me that, you know, if you were wrapping a branch or a pole with a ribbon, you know, and if you've got this going around that, and if somehow or other you don't have enough tautness on that ribbon, it slides down. It doesn't lose its shape of the spiral, and we still have the inside. But we're broken in a way, or we're pulled back to an earlier time, and our responses aren't. It seems to me, I mean, my own experience tells me that where I go is not, you know, at this point on the spiral, it's much lower on the spiral. And I somehow or other, I've misunderstood the book or taken it in wrong. Or
I think it's interesting that when we look at this through the lens of our personal experience, we get something different. And it would be different probably for each of us because we're so uniquely made and our histories are so unique. But I think that's true, that we can't say so easily that the spiral always takes us up. But, you know, Teilhard had, and I'm sorry I can't tell you where it's from, but over the years in reading him, he has something that I think is a lovely image, and it's partly that because we're human and we're here, we can't see the huge spiral. You know, we can't see the bigger, huge, so it's hard to tell whether we're going down or up, you know, at times. But I think this is part of what do we mean by up, and where are we hoping to go? Fascinating.
I think that you alluded to it earlier, that men may go through this process differently, which is why it's harder for you to relate to some of the stuff he says in his book. Men, as a rule, it's my own experience, are not as in touch with their feelings as women are. And it takes a 2x4 between the eyes to get their attention.
I would never have said that.
And my 2x4 was cancer.
Oh,
you know, I mean, it changed my whole perspective on life. And there were a lot of positive things that came out of that because I was looking for them. But so there is a gender difference, I think.
Thank you. Thank you. I was hoping we'd hear from men.
Many years ago, I guess it's like 20 or 30 years ago, a young girl in Glida, only 9 years old, had her leg amputated for cancer, and the cancer came back. But it seemed like nobody would tell her what was going on, and there was a lot of secrets, and the family didn't face up to it. But finally they did. But what did it was the little girl said to her mother one day, "Am I going to get better?" And your mother says, "No." And she says, "Well, I'm glad you told me, because I want to know who to leave all my toys to, especially my favorite teddy bear."
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
I think that is another example of how children really yeah. need a chance to be able to be involved in the reality of their own lives. And we know, if we look back at our lives when we were children, and the way death was dealt with in our family, mm-hmm. we know that some of it was not very helpful. All the mm-hmm. secrecy was not a helpful thing. I think somebody here had a hand up.
Tom's heading in the direction.
I was just thinking, when we witness someone who seems to rise up to the occasion and see the larger picture, how it's inspiring. The couple in Italy whose son was murdered by robbers that attacked their car years ago, and they decided to donate all his organs in Italy to save children's lives, really struck a chord with Europe on how they had failed to see the broader side of death. None of them, they questioned people, and 99.9% said they would never give their organs, and this made them change their perspective.
Yes.
So these parents were really quite exceptional to be able to see that in the middle of their grief.
In the middle of grief, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. And I think someone over here has had his hand up for quite a while.
Marie, you want to just stand up and speak loud?
Yeah. I was down in Culver City a few weeks ago. Well, my son works as an activity director at an assisted living facility, and while I was there, I talked to some of the residents, and I was telling my son about their stories, and he had been reading a book about communicating with the elderly, and he said that in the book the writer stated that there were two things that the writer thought were really important for people as they got older. And one was maintaining a sense of control, and the other was putting together for themselves and sharing with others their legacy. Uh-huh. And I think this morning you have illustrated beautifully that idea of sharing your legacy. And I'm talking about things that you've experienced, what you learned from them, possibly some of the mistakes you made along the way, wanting to share it with other people, to be helpful to them, and in a sense also trying to integrate it into a whole as a part of that process of sharing. So I think that perhaps all of us are thinking about our legacy in one way or another, to some degree or another, and again, you have showed us perfectly what that's all about.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
In the early 70s, while practicing medicine in San Luis Obispo, we gave credit to how it all started with the writings of Kubler-Ross.
Yes. Yes.
And what she did was to listen. And so I have always felt comfortable with listening and not necessarily having an agenda. And very recently, my sister's remark about our neighbor who is taking care of her daughter, the emphasis was always the daughter who is dying of cancer. We could just as well say the daughter who is living with cancer.
Yes.
And to give them the opportunity. And I have seen the hospice development in these many years paralleling, in a different way, making it better, not like the third world countries I worked in. There, the grandmother who was ill was not in a nursing home shut away, mm-hmm. but she was home and her family were in daily communication. And when she did die, they did not shun taking care of her body or burying her. Mm-hmm. And growing up as children in such an environment makes it ever so much easier mm-hmm. because death inevitably is part of life. It's just our perspective.
Yes, thank you. You know, one of the, and now that I've read so many things getting ready for today, I can't tell you where I got this phrase, and you might know it, but the phrase is living toward death, mm-hmm. which is what we're all doing.
Yeah.
We're living toward death. And the sooner we realize that, I think the healthier we become, for many reasons. For one thing, you know, it's kind of a relief to be able to say it out loud, at least for me. And also because, well, if that's the case, then I'd better really live.
Let's live. I'm not really sure I need this, Tom.
Probably not.
And listening, you talked about, you know, going in fits and starts and not knowing where the turning point. I can look back and see many turning points.
Yes.
So my move has been very gradual. Mm-hmm. And yet I've hit many insights. Turning point. The day my mother went into a nursing home.
Yes.
I mourned. When she died, I was ready. I accepted it. It was there. It had been coming.
Yes.
I think my father, it was a little harder. But other places and other times, events, dealing with illness, the first reaction is to pull back. Oh, I'm going to die. It's going to kill me. I can't be me. I'm not that old. I'm 77. But these are all points where you face mortality, you face reality, and you have to say, where do I go with this? There's one part of you says, let's curl up in a corner and that's it. And the other part says, no, this is the part of living. Where the end comes, I don't know. I have an aunt who has just celebrated her 103rd birthday. Bright-eyed, alert, fully competent. And this week she gets to meet her great-granddaughter for the first time.
Lovely.
Her namesake.
Great.
So, you know, it's for my aunt, and it rubs off on me. Life remains an adventure. You know, ill health comes along, cancer comes along, whatever. Yes, you react emotionally, and it's a shock that this is me. It's happening to one I love. And then you have to come to terms with it and say, life isn't over. It goes on. How long will it last? We don't know. But, so I stand here. I keep looking forward to things that are coming. And yet, I accept what's coming. It's
yes.
Great changes.
Yes. So all these turnings are preparing us, right? I remember one thing that in the hospice work, when we were reading Kubler-Ross, of course, that was our Bible essentially at the time. And we had memorized the stages, you know, we knew what those were. And somebody pointed out, and I've loved this, that, you know, these stages happen to us all the time. And then I realized it happens to me when the phone, in those days, without a cell phone in the house, the phone rings and you can't get to it in time. And you go through the five stages of death. Especially if you're waiting for him to call. You think, oh, no, that couldn't have happened. It had to be, you know, and then anger. Any fool who wouldn't let it ring more than five times. And then you go right through, and finally you get to the point where you say eventually, well, they'll call back. So, you know, it's like that. I think all of our lives are like that. So if we can see these things that Richard Rohr is talking about a little bit like that, that even without the big things, we are turning. We are moving in some way, in small ways. We're having experiences of God all the time. And we just, you know, we can go along and we can allow those to move us, and we don't need to think about them. But when we do think about them, it's kind of amazing. You know, we think, wow, what about that? You know? I was telling Dawn today that my youngest daughter, Sarah, who's more intuitive than the other two, was spending the night at my house, and she knew I was working on something, but we hadn't talked about it. And she said she would cook dinner, so that was great. So, last week, I'd had a dream because of all this, and it was about death, of course. And I was walking, and there was a granite mountain, very beautiful, not very big, and on the top was a tree with no leaves. And I looked at that in my dream self, and I liked it. I thought, wow. And I knew that was going, that was death out there. And I just had this deep satisfaction of believing, of feeling, that would be okay with me. That would be okay. So, I hadn't told Sarah this dream. This morning, it's just as she's getting in the car to leave, she said, oh, you know, I had an amazing dream last night. I dreamed that I died. And I dreamed that it was okay. And there was Mary Helen Post, her old Sunday school teacher that she loved dearly, who's now about 98, and there she was. And so I thought, well, this will be very nice, because now I get to spend time with Mary Helen. So now, we had not talked about any of that. Now, for me, that's what I would call an affirmation. Not a coincidence, but an affirmation. But yes, the Spirit is moving in us all the time. And we're in communication at that level without knowing it. And I don't think, I mean, I'm glad I don't know what it all means. It'd be too much to haul around in my head. Yeah. But to just know when it happens that we can be grateful for that.
I'm somewhat reluctant, since I'm kind of new to your group, to seem to be such a learned bunch, and having never studied philosophy or religion. But I'm getting a little depressed sitting here.
Aww.
And learning about all the tragedies of life, and somewhat apprehensive about what I sense. I have a little problem. Maybe it's the 2x4 up alongside the head. A little trouble with going back and collecting the tragedies from my life. And I don't think God loves me and gives me more gifts than the rest of you. So I think I have a problem. Perhaps I have a superior power of repression.
Well, that's always a possibility.
But I'm a bit apprehensive about these tragedies that are going to ensue in my life. So I think possibly we... Well, I'm only speaking for myself. Yes. I'm going to dwell on the joys
yes.
of my past life.
Yes. Yes. Thank you. Yeah. Someone has to hold that side down. And thank you for doing it. Anyone else?
Anyone over here? Okay. Here comes
Michael. Hey. Thanks, Anne. Always wonderful to hear you speak. And, you know, when you're speaking this morning, crystallized a thought for me, particularly it seems like everyone was very interested in reflecting on mortality. And so the thought comes to mind, perhaps, that in order to accept our humanity, a key first stage is accepting our mortality. As long as we deny or avoid or suppress that, maybe we aren't able to really accept our own humanity and all its frailties.
Yeah.
And then the other thought, in terms of your spiral, and I think somebody in a previous talk, talked about it like a slinky. So it's kind of a similar.
Don said that last
Don,
week.
Was that Don's image? But anyway, I actually, Don got me thinking about this the other week. And so I left a handout that I made up on the table from Abraham Maslow. And so maybe it's like an advance and retreat also.
Uh-huh.
I think that his model would suggest that.
Uh-huh.
And that sort of fit in for me with the book and the theme in terms of first half. And second half is you have to meet these other hierarchy of needs, or the hierarchy of needs. I'm sure most people are familiar with it. And we retreat back. So sometimes in our life we have to slip back for our need for affection or whatever before we can move toward the ideal of self-actualization.
Thank you, Michael.
Did you want to respond? Or
I think
you have a hand over here too.
Oh, right. Thanks. For many years, I worked with mainly the blind in the Department of Rehabilitation, and what dawned on me over the years are the steps Kubler-Ross talks about, mm-hmm. especially maybe with blindness, it's more symbolic of death.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the darkness, the inability to cope with it at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And what really struck me after some years, how I have to respect that person's grief.
Yes.
And I have to try and find, how's the spirit working with them?
Yes.
Where are they in these stages? Pardon me, because they're getting pushed. All these mainly were referrals from Social Security,
mm-hmm.
and SSI.
Yeah.
We want these people back on their feet.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to keep paying for care, and just to respect that in people and try to protect them from that. Like one lady too, everybody's pushing me, leave me alone.
Yeah.
So. Anyway, that respect for where other people are really struck me.
Thank you. You know, one of the things that that was certainly true from what I told you about my experience in the soup kitchen is when you realize how isolated we become if we aren't able to be with people in grief,
mm-hmm.
in illness, in all the things that people go through. You know, if we isolate ourselves and them. When that happens. So thank you.
Until I moved up here, I belonged to a dream group, and you mentioned a dream. So I'm going to put a dream in front of you. And it's from a friend. It's not mine. He walks into a room. There's nothing in the room except a big clock. And that was that.
Wow, I wish I had that dream. I like that
what
dream.
What did I say to you?
Well, if it were my dream, it could say a couple of things, depending on the day, the morning that I had. One thing it would say is, you're paying way too much attention to what time it is. That would be one thing. Another thing would be, it would be saying, you're not paying enough attention to what time it is. So I'd want to reflect on that for myself. What is that? Was it frightening to see the clock ticking? Or was it something that was pointing out to me that I wear a watch, I make sure I know what time it is, I always want to be on time. So I don't know. But, you know, what's wonderful about someone else's dream is that you can take it for yourself and make use of it. So,
could I make a comment now as a musician? Here's a little musician's comment.
Oh, good.
We've been talking about the last week we had an illustration of like going down and up, like a sine wave, or going up and down. And then Dawn, very helpfully, I think, said, you know, maybe we should see this more in terms of a spiral, like a slinky, because, and then you mentioned today the fact that that you spiral too. When a musician looks at a sine wave, the musician thinks, you know, it may look nice in theory, but you never hear it. The only thing that generates a sine wave is in the lab when you turn on one of these diagnostic things. The pure sound wave sounds like the devil.
It's the most bland sound you'll ever hear in your life. And in reality, the sound that most of us hear is a composite of all kinds of peaks and valleys. So at any given moment, you're not only going to be hearing the up, but the down. And you're going to hear not just the tone, but what we call the overtones and the partials and the things that go up to the fourth octave above. So, you know, don't smile when you see a sign, but say to yourself, oh my gosh, there's more to it than that.
Well, that may fit our experience a whole lot more. This up and down, chaotic, right?
It sounds great when you put it together.
Right.
Whoa.
I have one thing I want to ask. I want to give you before we end. So I want to do it now, so we have time. And it's just a possibility. And I learned it years ago, so long ago that I can't give you very good teaching about it. But I don't think it's that complicated. And I believe I learned it from Carol Carrick, who's here today, years ago. She taught a class at La Casa de Maria about timelines of our life. And she had us do it. It looked like a music staff. This is going to be rough, but. And we did four. You could do many. But here's what's interesting. If you take this as your beginning, so this is your birth, and here's where you are now. Okay. And you have years here, the bottom. You decide what you want to look at. For me at the time, she had suggested the outer world, the things that are going on in the outer world. So this is in the world, like in the news, let's say, the outer world. This one would be what was going on in my outer life, like I start to kindergarten, so outer life. This one is my biological life. And that would include all the movements in our biological self, moving into puberty, various diseases, having my tonsils out. It's fun to reflect because you can recall those events and you put them here on the timeline. These are all timelines. And this one actually became very important to me. This is your geography. Where did you live? Now, I grew up in a military family. When I was born, my father was a drill instructor at Parris Island. If you've ever seen The Great Santini, that was my dad. I went to 11 schools before I reached ninth grade. So the geography was pretty amazing, moving, what I could remember of where I lived, the big places I lived. And then what was going on in the outer world, of course, affected my upbringing and my childhood more than many people because of the wars. World War II and the Korean War. During the Korean War, we were living in a Quonset hut because we were waiting for quarters. And over my head in my bed, like this, was the map of Korea. And I knew where everybody was. And my friends... fathers were most all dying at the time at the Pusan Reservoir. See, so, wow. So you have that in the world. You have my outer life, going to school. And then I added a line that was my, because I was old enough to reflect on this, my spiritual life. Various conversion experiences that I could remember. But what's wonderful about doing it this way is that you see things starting to line up. There's a war, I move, I get sick. that might be too simple, but you can see stages. And so then Carol told us, are you remembering this, Carol?
No.
And then you know, where you find things, big things, you know, big things that kind of line up. You draw a line, okay, and then you'll have more. Some of them fall in between, but you know where they line up, you draw a line, and you take a look at what happens. And we realized in this group, it was pretty amazing, that these big things, these big shifts, seem to come in a pattern of 10 to 12 years. Mm. Is that fascinating? That sort of stuff fascinates me. But I give you this as a possibility for your own reflection on your life, and just to see what it reveals, and especially about the spiritual life. You know, what's happened to you? What is happening to you?
Anything
else?
Thank you.
You spoke about community, and in our culture, we don't tend to experience death as a community experience. I just wanted to share that I grew up in a Japanese American community in which I lived with my grandparents as well as my parents, and so there's three generations under one household.
Wow.
And I didn't know any different, or that people lived any other way. But one of the things that I think is unfortunate that's been a loss now, but I do remember when people died in our community, our Japanese community, that it was, the funeral was only one part of the event. And then you had a 1 month celebration, and then you had a 6 month celebration, and by God, when it was the year one, everybody came again. The small ones were probably family and very close friends, but they shared stories about the person, the deceased. The person still lived, you know, with the family, and so and they sang songs, you know, together. They told jokes, and of course, they shared food.
Yeah,
and
always.
So you know, this was a community experience. So I don't think that death was looked at as a lonely experience. Unfortunately, this is not happening as often anymore, but this was the way I grew up, and so it is a different outlook on.
Yeah, we can learn a lot from other cultures about this, and we've mentioned that earlier. Some of you have mentioned traveling in the third world. You see so many different ways of being, not only about death, but about the tragic pieces of life. You know, this tragic sense of life.
Thank you for recalling something that I maybe remember in a different way, but.
Well, I hope I was close to accurate.
I'm sure you were. I just want to share something, many things that have happened this week. I'll be brief, though. They all center around death. This week has been just amazing. Tom Dunlap, who was a massage therapist at La Casa de Maria, died suddenly. They found him. He didn't tell anybody he had cancer, and he just chose to go quietly.
Yes.
And there was a beautiful service in the Peace Garden. And that same day, my friend Margaret, whom we had taught together in the 50s, high school, and she'd since married, and she died of Alzheimer's, and her funeral's going to be on Saturday. A woman in our IHM community who died 3 days after her 98th birthday is going to have her funeral tomorrow.
Wow.
And yesterday when I had my hair cut, the woman who does it, said that her cousin's grandchild, 7 years old, died suddenly of a brain aneurysm, I guess. And of course, I've been thinking a lot about death and the spiraling, really, of all these stages from 7 to 50 something to 70 something, 80, I guess Margaret was, and 98. There's no one way. But the other thing that I want to recall is that when Juliet spoke at the Celtic series, she mentioned the thin time, and I guess Catherine did too, and maybe you did also. And Juliet has been reminding me about waking up at 3 or 4 in the morning and thinking of those who have gone before and lighting a candle. And I have awakened this week and thought of particularly Tom and Margaret. And so it's just been, I don't know, thinking
around.
Yes.
And as we grow older, we realize that we have lost huge numbers of people. My father died at 98, and I helped him do his Christmas cards two weeks before he died, and it was pretty amazing. We went through his address book. There were no friends left. No friends left. There were some nephews, you know, left, and his grandchildren, and I was the only child left. So you see, I mean, I got to see, just looking at the address book, the diminishment of that we do lose, but we gain new pieces. We expand our community in so many ways that it isn't all that tragic. My father had huge numbers of people he had gathered over the years who were younger than he. So that's a cautionary tale, isn't it? Thank you all very much. We're at the end.
Well, I'd like to thank Anne very much for this. I'd also like to see if we could end on a slightly more optimistic note. I sometimes sing songs for people who are in hospice. And one of the songs that they seem to warm up to and like the most is this song called What a Wonderful World. And the reason, I think, is not so, well, in the first stanza it talks about the trees of green and the red roses. In the second stanza it talks about the skies of blue and the clouds of white and the bright blessed days and the dark sacred nights. And then in the third stanza it talks about us. It says the colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people, you and me and everyone. And the last stanza is the great consolation stanza. It says, I hear babies cry, I watch them grow. I hear babies cry, I watch them grow. They'll learn much more than I'll ever know. And I think to myself, what a wonderful